After 3 hours of conjuring and summoning, I came up with absolutely nothing. I had spoken with nature spirits in the shape of a trio of tiny screech owls, and with messenger spirits, the couriers between the various realms within the Never Never. None of them knew anything. I plucked a couple of particularly nosy ghosts who lived around Chicago out of the spirit world, and summoned servants of the Telawith Taig, with whose king I was on good terms. I asked spirits of water what they and their kin had seen regarding Maggie, and stared into the flickering lights of creatures of sentient flame whose thoughts were revealed in the images quivering inside them. One of the fire spirits showed me an image that lasted for no more than 3 or 4 seconds, the face of the little girl in Susan's picture, pale and a little grubby and shivering with fear or cold, reaching out to warm her hands over the fluttering lights of a fire. In profile, she looked a lot like her mother, with her huge dark eyes and slender nose. She'd gotten something of my chin, I think, which gave her little face the impression of strength or stubbornness. She was much paler than Susan, too, more like her father than her mother that way. But then the image was gone. That was as close as I got. I sat down on my stool after 3 hours of work and felt more exhausted than at any time I could easily recall. I'd got nothing that would tell me where she was, nothing that would tell me what was in store for her, except for the single flicker of knowledge that Maggie was still alive. I'd gotten nothing. But even that might be enough. She was still breathing. Hang in there, kid. Dad's coming. I sat there on the stool for a moment, wearily. Then I reached for a piece of paper, an old pencil, and wrote, "Ivy, I need your help. It's for a little girl who is being held by bad people. Please contact me. Harry Dresden." Before I'd gotten finished writing my name, the phone rang. I'd just made contact with the archive, with the magically constructed catalog of every bit of knowledge mankind has ever written down. It resided in the head of a teenager, the sum of human learning in the hands of a girl who should have been going to 9th grade this year. Knowledge is power, and a couple of years before, the archive had proved it. As a child not much older than Maggie, she had pitted her magic against the skills of beings with centuries of experience and come out, for the most part, ahead. She was an unwholesomely powerful child, and while she had always comported herself with the gravity of a woman of 40, I had seen flashes of the child supporting the vast burden of the archive. I knew what would happen if that child ever decided to take control of how the archive was administered. It would probably look a lot like that episode of The Twilight Zone with the monstrous little kid with superpowers. The phone rang again. I shivered and answered it. We'd run a long line down into the laboratory, and the old rotary phone sat near Molly's desk, benefiting from being on the fringes of such a well-organized place. "Hello?" "It's Kincaid," said a man's baritone. Kincaid was Ivy's driver, bodyguard, cook, and all-around teddy bear. He was the single deadliest gunman I'd ever had the terror of watching, and one of a relatively few number of people who I both disliked and trusted. He had once described the method he would use to kill me, if he had to, and I had to admit that he had an excellent chance of succeeding. He was tough, smart, skilled, and had a mercenary sense of honor. Whoever held his contract was his charge, body and mind, and he never abrogated a contract once he had signed it. "Dresden," I replied, "this line probably isn't clear." "I know," Kincaid replied. "What do you want?" "I need to find a child. She was taken by the Red Court a few days ago. We believe her to be somewhere in Mexico." "Somewhere in Mexico?" Kincaid said, and I could hear his grin. "You tried walking around and yelling her name really loud yet?" "I'm getting there," I said. "Look, does she know anything or not?" Kincaid muffled the phone with something, probably his hand. I heard his low, buzzing voice as he asked a question. I might have heard a light soprano voice answering him. Kincaid returned to the phone and said, "Ivy says she can't get involved, that the business you're on is deadly. She dares not unbalance it for fear of changing the outcome. I made a growling sound. God damn it, Kincaid. She owes me one. Remind her who came and took her away from those fucking Denarian lunatics. Kincaid's voice became quieter, more sober. Believe me, she remembers, Dresden. But she isn't free to share her knowledge like you or me. When she says she can't tell you, she's being literal. She physically cannot let such information leave her head. I slammed the heel of my hand into a wall and leaned on it, closing my eyes. Tell her, I said, that this is information I must have. If she can't help me, I'll be taking it up with other sources, the ones in my green notebook. Kincaid spoke with someone again. This time I definitely heard Ivy's voice answering him. She can't tell you where the girl is, Kincaid said. There was a hint of steel in his voice, warning me not to push too hard. But she says she can tell you someone who might. Any help would be greatly appreciated, I said, exhaling. She says to tell you that before you try the green book, there's something else you might consider. The last man you want to see might have useful information. I understood what she was talking about at once and groaned. Damn it, I muttered. Damn it. I dialed another number. A receptionist asked me how she could direct my call. This is Harry Dresden, I said quietly. Put me through to Mr. Marcone's personal line, please.